We'd like to open it up to your questions. If you just wait for Carl, who has the microphone,
I don't think I need a.
Yeah, but we're recording it as a point to put on the web. So, Carl.
Fine. I'd like to ask this question of Jonathan. Is he encouraged with a proposed policy that candidates for the police department who no longer have their prior drug arrest has relevant factoring in becoming police officers? In other words, police officers who serve time for drug offenses will now be enforcing a drug law. Wouldn't that not make them more compassionate in their application?
That's a good question. Is this on?
Yeah.
I'm not terribly hopeful, though. There seem to be two schools of thought as the baby boom generation, which many of whom took drugs in their youth or early adulthood, move into positions of power. Some of them are perhaps more compassionate and see the hypocrisy of brutal crackdowns on others who have engaged in activities really no more severe than they did in their youth. The other reaction is to try to forget about their own past, as Al Gore seems to have managed and others, and become holier than thou in this drug war, if you'll pardon my mixed metaphor. One of the problems with the police is that the incentive structure the police face heavily supports the war on drugs, and that goes to things like asset forfeiture laws, which directly support the growth of police departments. And indeed, some of the economists I mentioned have shown that the rise in the drug war in the mid-80s was directly related to federal law, which shared proceeds from asset forfeitures with local police departments. Lo and behold, it's not very surprising that they followed their incentives. And so unless those incentives are changed, I'm not too hopeful that the change in the mix of police officers will help.
Well, we just started to talk about incentives, and I don't think there's been a real discussion about money. Most things...
Can you keep it to a question?
Okay. What do you... If you could apply the term follow the money to any of your points of views, would you have something to say about that phrase, follow the money, as it relates to the global drug threat?
If I'd had time, I would have talked about the international flows of money twice, once in the early 80s and again in the mid-90s. Mexico was on the point of defaulting on all its loans, and in fact announced that it would. And twice, the American government came through with emergency loans. I think in the Clinton case, it was done overnight, really, $40 billion. That money was lent on the assumption that it would be repaid. In the first case, in the early 80s, the CIA actually did a study, how much of Mexico's foreign exchange earnings come from drugs. And the answer is actually reproduced photographically, their report, in James Mill's book, The Underground Empire. They ran two countries together, which sort of fudges it a bit. They said the foreign exchange earnings of just two countries, Colombia and Mexico, probably 75% come from drugs. Well, supposing Mexico had defaulted, supposing they hadn't had that 75% coming from drugs, you were three or four of your top banks in this country would have been technically bankrupt. So you have to ask, what does a bank president think about drugs coming through Mexico? The second example is in 1994. The figures this time come from the Mexican side. The Mexican Attorney General reported $28 billion of foreign exchange earnings. We're not talking about money here, but the important thing, money that you can pay back to the United States, $28 billion from drugs, probably more than the sale of all other commodities, such as oil, for example, combined. Now, I tested this on a vice president of a very well-known bank. I don't want to put her on the spot, but a bank that was definitely exposed in this debt situation. She didn't know about the 1980s, but when I began to talk about the 1990s, she cut me off and she said, "Oh, that was drug money," she said. So the banks know that that's how they're getting their banks. The one country that never had to reschedule its debts in the 1980s in Latin America was Colombia.
Alex, did you want to say something?
No, I was going to say that it's been absolutely marvelous to follow down the years the U.S. press, which report, you know, the sting operations of Mexican banks and the incredible silence they've kept on the fact that U.S. banks have been deeply involved in money washing, as indeed Milian Rodriguez, who's now serving in a federal penitentiary, who was a money washer accountant for the Medellin cartel, was arrested in the U.S., I think carrying at the time $10 million. And he had spreadsheets showing how much money he was bringing in, contributions made to various political campaigns. My brother made a film for WGBH on it. And Milian Rodriguez, very articulate, well-educated bloke, talked about it. But again, it's one of those subjects that you run across quite frequently where no matter how often it's pointed out or said in slightly non-official publications, it will always stay off the official agenda.
Other questions? Gentlemen?
Yeah, speaking of Mexico, for the first time, it looks like they have a horse race for the presidential election. Is there anything out there that suggests that Vicente Fox and PAN will be any less corrupt than the PRI?
I'm not really an expert on Mexico, but I gather that PAN some time ago sort of, just like PRI, dissolved into two factions, one with the so-called bureaucrats and one the so-called dinosaurs, who were the bigger drug traffickers were the dinosaur side, although I must say the Salinas de Gortari family seems to have done pretty well as bureaucrats out of this. And the PAN also is split into the people who genuinely oppose this whole system in PAN, who I gather are not major players, and then people like Fox, who have learned how to play the game. And the people I talk to are not sure that it's really going to be terribly different if Fox is elected, and it seems quite likely that he will be.
Actually, can I just add, there's sometimes a rather arrogant supposition on the part of U.S. authorities and U.S. press that all it takes is some order from a head of state who's really not corrupt to stop the drug traffic. If you read occasional accounts in the New York Times or elsewhere about what happens to those brave but rather foolhardy Mexican drug agents who aren't corrupt and who end up beheaded, and I won't go through all the grisly details, but a Mexican president can't just order an end to the drug traffic. With the billions of dollars at stake, you know, so central to their economy, as Peter said, these are structural problems. It will never be solved by simply a change of government or, you know, a wish to end corruption.
What I don't understand is how, with a general as the head of the war on drugs, we constantly violate one of the principles of war that military men are taught, which is to reinforce success and abandon failure.
Anyone want to comment on
that? Well, we don't understand it either.
Well, it comes down to what you define as success. Yes, if success is counterinsurgency abroad and social control at home, then you can argue the drug war is a success on those terms.
This is from our book, Cocaine Politics, the military realized after Vietnam that foreign engagements were going to be very unpopular. And they actually scratched their heads, how can we sell foreign engagements to the American people? And a man called Gradlestein, a colonel, Special Forces commander, said that the way to sell it to the American people is to declare that the enemy are narco-terrorists. And we quote about a paragraph on page one. If those of you who bought the book, Cocaine Politics, page 198, you can see how he said, this will give us the moral high ground and will silence our opponents. This actually goes back to 1974, when up till then the United States had been voting every year aid to police forces in Latin America. And when facts came out about the amount of torture that the people we had trained were inflicting on their people, Congress terminated that kind of police assistance. But the same year, other people said, well, we can start giving drug assistance to the same countries. And the amount of drug assistance that was voted was roughly equal to the amount of police assistance which had just been canceled. So it's been hypocrisy from the very beginning, but I think Alex's point is a good one. The main objective is to keep the military in this, and also police, by that way, for that matter, in this kind of business.
As much as I appreciate this analysis of the symptoms of the drug war, I must observe and ask your comment on this. I feel that the prohibition of whatever, or a crusade against whomever, has been the great political success of the last 1,000 years, whether we look at the Crusades, whether we look at the Spanish Inquisition, or whether we look at the prohibition of alcohol. Prohibition itself is a runaway political success. It is the means, the operative means, by which we give the lie to Abraham Lincoln.
Does he have a question?
This is a question. I ask for your comments on this. I'm being a little provocative. Abraham Lincoln said you couldn't fool all the people all the time, but now we can fool enough of the people enough of the time. May I ask for comments on that, please?
I don't want to do all the talking, but the Crusades were a way of keeping a totally dysfunctional class of warrior knights going for a little bit longer than they should have. I think the kings liked the Crusades because it got the warrior knights off your own land and onto somebody else's land, but I hardly see it as a very progressive element. Spain really suffered for the Inquisition, which drove the creative middle class elements out of Spain and turned what at the time was probably the most progressive country in Europe into the most backward in the matter of 300 years. So these are analogies we should think about very seriously, but they're not, you can't put them under the rubric of success stories.
Politically they were.
Yeah, he was.
I mean, it's true. They have, obviously prohibition has existed, and the question is why, and how do we deal with it?
My question is...
Well,
my question is to all three speakers. I'd like a definition of state. That is, how did this great American country get so corrupt? And the second part of that question is, what is your opinion on sort of the unifying hypothesis put forward by L. Fletcher Prouty to account for the post... at least part of what's happened in the post-war period.
Anyone take that first?
Could you give the speakers the mic?
Yeah, they have
Well, I was using the state in the sense of the combination of, you know, interests who hold the power, exercise the power of coercion and governorship, in the sense of, you know, the dominant class as represented by government, which is its executive committee, which old Marxists will recognize as the tag from the radical past. I can't remember what L. Fletcher Prouty said. I don't believe most of what L. Fletcher Prouty says, so I mean, I think I'd probably disagree with whatever he did say, although I don't want to. I mean, he's the secret team guy and all that, isn't he? Yeah. I always think the team is open. It's not secret. I think I might differ with my trusty colleagues here. The people talk about secret government. I think it's fairly obvious who the villains are, you know. Their faces appear in the newspaper every day. No secrecy needed. They're there. We can look at them all the time.
Whom are you labeling?
What? As the... Well, I think Fletcher Prouty, the thesis by and large is that there's a covert team running the show. It's a slight, I think, a cousin of the idea that the CIA is a rogue agency, that there are forces at work. I mean, it's a long strain in analysis, you know, whether it's the Freemasons or this or the Jews or somebody is doing it, and we don't know who they are. I tend to generally disagree with that and say that the people who you think are running the show, by and large, you can identify them. You can identify the class interest. You can identify the economic interest, and there they are. And you don't need to scuttle under the bed and find a Freemason or a secret teamster, or whoever it is, because we know they're there.
I actually wrote a book on this subject called Depolitics, and I must be a fairly bristly character because I managed to disagree with people like Alex Coburn on the one hand, who said, you know, it's all perfectly obvious, there's a structure there. And I also managed to disagree explicitly with Fletcher Prouty, who says there is a secret team who is or a secret government managing everything behind the scenes. I do believe that there are what I call deep political considerations here. That part of the problem is that there are certain things that go on in our society that we don't want to talk about. And one of them, which Alex did talk about, but most people don't, is that the CIA has been in bed with criminals from the time it got started. Local police forces is often the same thing, that a very convenient way to run parts of the city that you have trouble getting into is to tolerate the existence of organized gangs who do it for you. And if they're selling cocaine, heroin, they'd rather have, let me tell you, this is a fact, they'd rather have heroin dealers in South, cocaine dealers in South Central LA than have black dancers, that's for sure. And this is not a joke. So what ends up is that things are going on that we do not acknowledge and we do not talk about. And believe me, our present drug crisis in this country is something which we never talk about honestly. If you see a politician get on a TV camera talking about drugs, you can expect it's going to be empty rhetoric, because very often that politician may have a partner in a law firm who helped get him elected because of the amount of business he was doing with people who are part of the drug trade. So I just, to sum it up, it's not a secret team that's somehow outside of the system. It definitely is the system. But not all of the system is up there on the TV camera for you to look at. And if you look into the financing of parties and things like that, it drives that home.
If I could just actually just emphasize that, I think there's a kind of happy middle ground there, much as Peter said. And I think a great example is when the Justice Department in the early 1990s made a deal with the CIA, literally saying that the CIA did not have to inform the Justice Department about crimes being committed by agents or people that CIA was working with. This is about as blatant a hypocritical act. At the very time that the Reagan administration was proclaiming the war on drugs, the Justice Department was explicitly letting off the hook all the people working with the CIA. So we had not a cabal in the CIA doing this, but the Justice Department doing it. The CIA was acting in accordance with Reagan administration policy. It was all being done in secret, lest this offend the American people. But the even bigger irony is, now that it's public, how many newspapers have reported this? I think Alex may have written a column on this, taking the LA Times to task. But it wasn't the news pages of the LA Times or other papers telling us this. So that's a kind of mind-boggling scandal of my former profession that's rather heartbreaking.
My question is, or please remind me, what precipitated the end of prohibition? Because I'm sure you had as much corruption and so on back in the 30s as we have now, and somehow the American public opinion was changed.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. People have mentioned prohibition. I think it was the changed atmosphere just before the Second World War, right? And the fact that, I mean, I'd like to put a defense of prohibition, let's face it. Jonathan said that, you know, when drugs were legal, it was a period of growth. But what about the 20s? Period of unparalleled growth and ebullience in American society, accompanied by prohibition. Health, in terms of health, prohibition was rather a success, actually. I'll give you some examples. Cirrhosis of the liver was running at 16 per 100,000 in 1900. By 1930, after a period of prohibition, it was down to 8.2. And then, since prohibition was reappealed, by 1968 it was up to 19. TB. In 1870, per 100,000, there were 460 people with TB. 1900, it was 264. And prohibition was a tremendous success because a lot of people obeyed the law and didn't drink, which meant that their nutrition was better. Their vulnerability to disease sank. And by 1930,
TB was down to 68 per 100,000. Now, I don't want to issue a defense of prohibition because it gave rise to the Kennedy family. And that's, you know, a rousing argument just by itself against prohibition. But it does go back, I just close, it does go back to the point I tried to make before, that, you know, booze was a huge problem. Prohibition was a coercive instrument, and it was obviously flouted. It led to widespread contempt for the law. It led to the corruption of police departments. It led to Universal Pictures. It led to all sorts of things. And Camelot. Well, it did. Jules Stein founded Universal, and Jules Stein was a band leader with Capone, who, you know, flourished during band-era prohibition rackets. Hollywood did well out of this. But the point is twofold. And again, you should, I think it has to be thought of. What, is there an element of coercion that's necessary in drug treatment? This goes back to the issue of drug courts, drug therapy. And two, how much coercion is necessary? And two, if you regard prohibition as, on the one hand, you can, it's been, I'm, you think I'm being provocative, but epidemiologists have made, like Ayer, have made very sound defenses of prohibition, saying it was a great social health experiment. I kid you not. This, and the stats, were, I gave you a few. You can go on with that. You have to, therefore, see these problems of addiction as public health problems. And I suggested that we're coming into an era where we need to be very sophisticated and clear-headed about what we're really talking about here.
I think it would be very good for us to study what happened at the end of Prohibition. I don't totally disagree with what Alex just said, but I think two factors that play. One was that the amount of the emergence of organized crime as a phenomenon, with some rather spectacular shootouts towards the end of Prohibition, but perhaps even more important was the sudden deflation with the collapse of the stock market. And the stock market was really revived by the laundering of prohibition money into the stock market, which now meant that the prohibition players were players in not on the dark side of the economy, but at the center of the economy. And, of course, when the decision was made to legalize alcohol, people like the Kennedys became major distributors in the new thing. So it was a way of saying, okay, well, we've tried fighting it, now let's all work together to get the American economy going again.
Right, we could just say what this very day, another fortune made by Prohibition, the Seagram fortune, just been bought by, a Belgian water utility?
This gentleman then this.
I'd like to ask a question about all of the money you talked about. How much of this money has got into our political parties, our court systems, and also our international corporations? Have they benefited from this in drug war?
Well, we certainly know of individual drug traffickers who people convicted, you know, I want to be clear here, people convicted of cocaine trafficking, like Leonel Martinez, a very big contributor to Bush Sr. and Jeb Bush in Florida. And I think that that's just the tip of the iceberg, frankly. Usually it's done through secondary and third parties, but not in the case of Leonel Martinez. And then I like the example of Farhad Azima, whose airline, Global International, was involved in Iran-Contra and was also involved with these heroin-trafficking Afghan guerrillas. He not only gave to Clinton and to Gore, but just to be safe, he also gave to Fred Thompson, who was supposed to be instigating this whole thing from the Republican side.
Well, but I would just add that one can always find individual cases of these contributions. And some may have led to political influence to protect an individual from time to time. I'm not sure these contributions have a systemic or structural effect. And the second point I would like to make is the drug money flows are indeed probably huge if you add it up around the world. But I think it's a little misleading to conclude from that somehow the world economy is propped up, or the U.S. economy in particular is propped up by the drug traffic. If demand for drugs ended, people would be demanding other products, other services, other forms of entertainment. The money would flow someplace else. So there are a lot of distorting effects of the drug traffic and particularly drug prohibition, but I don't think it's quite as systemic as some people say.
This gentleman right here. I'm good. Back here.
Along this line of following the money, effects of the drug trafficking on the political process, do you feel that the drug traffickers, the big cartels, actually are opposed or in favor of the war on drugs?
Well, I'm sure they're in favor of it. Every time, I read a very depressing testimony to Congress by a man called Andy Messing, who's somebody you should watch, the National Security Defense Foundation. He said, it's wrong to call this a war because we're never going to win. Let's call it a conflict, and let's accept that all we're going to do is reduce supply by 10 or 15 or 20%. That's a good thing, he said. Well, another way of putting it is that we're going to stay in this conflict to keep the price up. And if there wasn't a war and the price went down, then it wouldn't be the profitable enterprise that it is now.
I thought many of the Colombian cartel leaders, though, actually were seeking a sort of nonviolent end to the war. I think they thought they were in a good position probably to dominate illegal drug traffic.
Yeah, but I think they're also prepared to get out of the drug traffic. They have made their billions.
Making your billions rarely stops people from wanting to make more billions. I think...
like the Bronfmans who go into entertainment.
Right.
Then we have time for one more question.
No, I didn't this will get a little heavy, but basically it looks, can I ask you if there's any way we can deal with the drug traffic and the systemic money that flows through it, as well as the arms traffic and the mendacity and everything else? I think we're totally addicted to it, not just the system and not just the guys at the top or the secret government, but you and I and everybody else. I don't see any way to turn this thing around without a huge amount of societal dislocation. And I think you should look at that.
Well, I think we live in a society in which the whole drug trade has become part of the support of that society. But I think it's a very sick one. And I think it's vulnerable at the point that they have to lie to us. That's why maybe I'm putting too much emphasis on this. But the lies in this House Committee report are so crass and so frightened, I might say, is that I feel that they feel are on the point of being exposed. I can tell you this, that if one American in 100 would read the HITS reports and read the Bromwich Department of Justice report, there would be a political movement to demand a restructuring of the relationship between our intelligence agencies and criminal forces in the third world. And I think we need that. I think you can only have democracy when people know how things are being done. You cannot have a democracy when everything is covert and we are fighting a war in Colombia with MPRI and DynCorp, which are private corporations people have never heard of. But if we get all this out and expose it, that is the only way I see how we can turn it around, and we have to.
You say addiction. I mean, as an couple of examples of the way a drug problem flows into another problem, I live a lot of the time in Humboldt County. Now, where, you know, hippies grow dope, ranchers grow dope. Why do ranchers grow dope? There's long-term agricultural economic depression. Ranchers don't get too much money for their calves. Why don't they get money for the calves? Because the bulk of the money in the beef trade is made by the processors. The processors, the Iowa beef processors. The price for a rancher of a calf has barely gone up in 20 years. The price of beef in the supermarket has barely gone down. Where is the money going? It's going to the middle guy. What is one of the consequences? Most ranchers in Humboldt or Mendocino or around there will grow some dope to supplement their income. It's an economic necessity, in the same way that if you denude South Central LA of any manufacturing facility and the only employment of opportunity there, or in North Richmond here in the Bay Area, is dealing in drugs, if there's no other job, then you've got a drug problem.
So these problems then flow into larger social problems. And one of the baneful effects of the drug war is that it's cast in this rigid perspective without seeing all the endless ramifications of larger social dislocation, which is very often as simple as how can you get by in a small rural community. Cocaine, you can go to any small town in America and see in an economic depression which restaurants are surviving because they're washing through drug money. That's how it works. So you have to look at these larger pictures all the time, and then a drug problem becomes an economic justice problem.
I would also just, or at least I would disagree with the assumption of the question that the drug trade or our addiction to drugs is so deeply rooted that it would be wrenching to... Yeah, well, I don't think that the money from the illicit gun trade is all that enormous. I think that the reality is, I think Milton Friedman has made this observation, no doubt other has too, that the power of special interest groups is often inversely proportional to their size. The reason is that small ones have very concentrated interests and focus their lobbying power, their political power, or even covert power very effectively. Large groups tend to be more diffuse, and it's harder really to satisfy their needs. I think the interest groups who benefit most from the war on drugs are fairly small. I think if we ended, say, our program of trying to control the destiny of third world countries and intervening through their military and police forces in guerrilla wars, we would be better off, not worse. There would be less wrenching dislocation if we stayed out of Colombia than if we go in and create another Vietnam. There would be less wrenching dislocation if we move towards treating drug problems as medical and social problems rather than law enforcement and military problems. So I think we have everything to gain and very little to lose.
One thing I might just add to what Jonathan just said was that many of the economists that we work with are from the so-called public choice school of economics, who point out that politics is a contest, it's a competition among interest groups to gain control of the police power to be used in coercive measure to benefit themselves, essentially to enrich themselves, as opposed to obtaining wealth through voluntary means. And the nature of politics is that those that benefit directly are going to be a small number who can benefit from very modest changes, and they can diffuse the cost to the public through taxes and liability and any other cost, ways of essentially distributing these costs that result. And but I do think on the positive side, it's important to recognize that it's only been a very relatively small number of years when this movement for example, medical marijuana has come into being and now has 70%+ popular support. To me, the problem as far as how do we get between the situation now and where we'd like to be is largely one of information, not only of information, but the public still by and large believes the official pronouncements that the DEA and other entities are indeed serving the public. My view is that even if the DEA was run by angels, it would be antisocial because of the nature of the way government institutions operate, partly as the public choice economists point out. In any event, I want to take this opportunity to thank all of our panelists. And those of you who have not gotten their books, there are copies upstairs. They'd be delighted to autograph them for you. If you're not on a mailing list, please give us your address and so forth. If you have further questions, I'm sure the authors would be happy to address those as well. And thank you. We hope to see you again next time.